This talk is, actually, before I start, I should say that while I'm going to give my talk in English, you are very welcome to ask questions in French. J'ai passé des cours longtemps ici à Paris, and indeed, j'ai pris des cours avec Claudine Tiercelin. Donc, I may understand your question. I will probably answer in English. So with that, I'm going to be speaking about the origins of perceptual knowledge, and this talk is from material that is part of a larger book project that I've been working on for quite some time, and that is, knock on wood, almost finished. And this is the very last part of the book, so it presupposes all sorts of things that I talked about earlier, but it also stands more or less on its own feet. Okay, so developing this view of perceptual knowledge, I'm drawing on a view of perceptual evidence that has a reasonably long tradition, and it is a view on which that I'll call the capacity view, according to which evidence and allied notions such as justification and knowledge are to be understood in terms of the mental capacities employed. So the historical roots of this idea go back to at least Aristotle. And so the idea is that the notion of a capacity is explanatory basic. It's because a given subject is employing a mental capacity with a certain nature that her mental states have epistemic force. And alternative approaches, as you're all aware, are dogmatism, according to which conscious mental states are explanatory basic, the view posits a particular rule for justification, namely that if it perceptually seems that P, then one has prima facie justification for P. Knowledge first views that treat knowledge as explanatory basic and analyze justification in terms of a deficiency of knowledge. Our very own Clayton Littlejohn defends a version of this view. And then reliabilism that treats reliability as the reliability of the perceptual or cognitive system as explanatory basic and analyzes evidence and justification as a product of this reliable system. And there was a talk earlier today that was committed to such a view. And so, so on the first cluster of views, conscious mental states are explanatory basic, and the second, knowledge, on the third, reliability. And by contrast to these views, the capacity view treats capacities as explanatory basic and analyzes evidence, knowledge, and justification in terms of the capacities employed. And of course, these options are neither exclusive nor exhaustive. There are other possible views. These are just some of the main views people defend today. These options are not exclusive in that one might think that more than one of these four elements are explanatory basic. So various people have been defending sort of a knowledge first virtue epistemology, for example. Or one might think that what is explanatory basic is something else entirely. Okay, now among the capacity views, you can distinguish between reliabilist capacity views, according to which the epistemic force of mental states brought about by employing capacities stems from the reliability of the capacities employed. So my colleague Ernie Sosa defends this view, as well as John Greco, Bergman, and my wonderful student, Lisa. Well, she's no longer my student. She's now a professor, Lisa Meraki. And by contrast, I seem to be one of the lonely defender of the non-reliabilist capacity view, according to which the epistemic force of mental states brought about by employing capacities stems from something other than their reliability, and as I want to argue, it stems from the systematic linkage between capacities and what they function to do in the good case. Okay, and so, so the plan in this paper is to exploit a view of the epistemic force of perceptual experience that I've argued for in a series of papers, for a view of perceptual knowledge. And the basic idea of this view I'll exploit is that perceptual experience is constitutively a matter of employing perceptual capacities that function to discriminate and single out particulars in our environment. So the idea is that regardless of whether one is in the good case, you know, the case of perception, or the bad case, the case of hallucination or illusion, employing such perceptual capacities yields a mental state that provides us with a weak type of evidence that I call phenomenal evidence, and employing such capacities in the good case, that is the case of a successful perception, provides us moreover with a second strong type of evidence that I call factive evidence. And the notion of a capacity is understood as explanatory basic. It's because a given subject is employing a perceptual capacity with a certain nature that her mental states have epistemic force. And as I'll show, this is a view of perceptual evidence that is externalist, yet not disjunctivist. And I'll speak a lot about discrimination to the extent that these capacities, these perceptual capacities, function to discriminate and single out particulars. And since this is a room full of epistemologists, I feel the urge to specify that when I speak about discrimination, I don't mean what, you know, lots of epistemologists mean when they mean discrimination, namely discriminating from relevant alternatives. Rather, I mean something very cognitively primitive, the kinds of things that cognitive scientists talk about or vision scientists talk about when they talk about discrimination, namely that, you know, when I see this blue chair over there, I discriminate blue from beige, and, you know, noticing the differences between the blueness and the beigeness is what, among other things, allows me to be perceptually aware of this chair. Okay. So here's the plan. So first, I'll briefly lay out the view of the epistemic force of perceptual experience that I've argued for in detail elsewhere, and then I will exploit this view for a view of perceptual knowledge. Then in the third part, I will apply the view to three Gedje cases. And by that point, the time will probably be up, but if there is some time, I will show how you could move beyond, how you can extend this view beyond perception, and we'll contrast it from relative alternative strategies, so knowledge first view, virtue epistemology, and reliabilist views. Okay, so without further ado, so let's look at what happens when we are in the good case, and so are perceptions related to what we purport to single out in our environment. So when we perceive, we employ our perceptual capacities by means of which we discriminate particulars in our environment. You know, say we see, a black bag on a beige desk. We employ our capacity to discriminate the black color of the bag from the surround beige color of the desk, and in doing so, we're able to single out the black bag from its surround. Now, I'll be talking a lot about singling out particulars. And what I mean with particulars are, you know, objects such as bags, but also property instances such as the instance of the black that this bag instantiates. You can think of those as tropes if you like, but you can just think of them as property instances without committing yourself to tropes. And also events such as the bag lying on the desk, or perhaps the bag falling off the desk. And and I talk about singling out rather than referring to particulars, just so as to highlight the cognitively low-level nature of perception and, you know, the potentially proto-conceptual nature of perception. So at least on the way most people talk about reference requires quite sophisticated linguistic capacities, whereas, you know, perception arguably does not require any such capacities. And the idea is that in hallucination and illusion, if we possess a perceptual capacity, we can employ this capacity even if we fail to discriminate and single out particulars in our environment. So if I possess the capacity to discriminate, you know, black from other colors, I can employ it even when I'm not perceiving, but rather hallucinating. And so what the perception case and the hallucination case have in common is that in both cases, I employ the perceptual capacities. The way they differ is that in one case, I single out a particular, and the other case, the hallucination case, I fail to single out a particular. And in such cases, When we fail to single out what we purport to single out, we employ the perceptual capacity baselessly. And now you're probably wondering what I mean with perceptual capacity. So a perceptual capacity is a mental capacity, a low-level mental capacity that functions to discriminate, single out, and in some cases classify a particular kind, such as instances of red. And for those of you who care about such matters, this is an idea that's well based in vision science and other perceptual sciences. And such perceptual capacity are determined by general functional relations between the organism and its environment, for instance, global patterns of the organism's response to its environment. And critically, the perceptual capacities are individuated externally. So, you know, I have thousands, perhaps millions of perceptual capacities, and each one of them is individuated by what that capacity functions to single out. So my red capacity is individuated by red things in the environment. My capacity to discriminate and single out Bordeaux is individuated by Bordeaux things. And these capacities stand in complicated hierarchical relations to each other. So my capacity to discriminate and single out Bordeaux things is a sub-capacity of my red capacity and is different from my blue capacity, but they're both sort of on the same level, whereas my capacity to discriminate, you know, colors from shapes, sort of more high level than each one of those, and so forth. And if we possess a perceptual capacity that functions to discriminate and single out, say, instances of red, we're in a position to discriminate and instances of red from other colors in our environment and to single out instances of red. So that's to say that the possession conditions of a perceptual capacity is understood counterfactually, and it's understood counterfactually such that, there's no kind of historical evolutionary phylogenetic or ontogenetic history to my possession of perceptual capacities. As a matter of empirical fact, I happen to possess the capacities I do because of my history. But as I will show, the epistemic force of my capacities does not in any way depend on the history of my using those capacities, which is to say that, you know, someone like Davidson's Swamp Man possesses all the capacities that, and is in, it can have mental states with the very same epistemic force that Davidson has, where, you know, Swamp Man is this somewhat bizarre thought experiment of Davidson, a being that came about by a lightning bolt, and is identical to Davidson, but has a history completely different than Davidson. So that's to say that this is a certain kind of time slice epistemology, this view. Okay. Insofar as one can employ capacities to single out particulars or employ them while failing to single out the particular one purports to single out, their employment is fallible. In this respect, the view differs fundamentally from, say, Williamson's view in Knowledge and its Limits, that the methods employed in gaining evidence are infallible and the mental states yielded is always factive. But while employing capacities is fallible, this does not mean that the good case and the bad case are on a par. So I want to say that in perception and a relevant hallucination, the perceptual capacities employed are the very same. However, as I will argue shortly in more detail, any employment of a capacity in the bad case is derivative from its employment in the good case. The employment of a capacity in the bad case fails to fulfill the function of the capacity and therefore fails to yield fact evidence and knowledge, and thus we have mere phenomenal evidence. By contrast, the employment of the same capacity in the good case is constitutively a success in that it yields fact evidence and so allows the subject to gain knowledge. Okay, and now the key background idea is going to be that the key background idea about perception, perceptual consciousness that I will be assuming here, but that I have argued for elsewhere in a paper that recently came out in Nous, is that what it is to be perceptually conscious is to engage in a certain mental activity, namely the mental activity of employing perceptual capacities. So the idea is that what it is to be in a phenomenal state as of something red is to employ the perceptual capacity that functions to discriminate and single out red things. And this is a radical view in that it departs with a more or less 2,000 years strong orthodoxy about perceptual consciousness, according to which what it is to be perceptually conscious is to be sensibly aware of, you know, some thing, where that thing could be a property, a sense data, an intentional object. There's a huge range of difference in what that thing is that we're sensibly aware of. And my idea is, no, we should do away with this tradition and rather think of perceptual consciousness in terms of a kind of mental activity, namely the activity of employing perceptual capacities. And so more specifically, the idea is that phenomenal states are constituted by employing perceptual capacities in a sensory mode, that is, modes such as seeing, hearing, touching, smelling, or tasting. And so the idea is that if the same perceptual capacities are employed in the same sensory mode, the same phenomenal state is constituted. So the same perceptual state is constituted with the same phenomenal character. So insofar as perceptual capacities are individuated by the mind-independent particulars that they function to discriminate and single out, and insofar as perceptual consciousness is constituted by employing perceptual capacities, this is an externalist account of perceptual consciousness. But it's modestly externalist insofar as the perceptual capacities can be employed derivatively in illusion and hallucination, while the relevant subject fails to single out what the capacities she employs function to single out. And so perceptual capacities can be employed in illusion or hallucination, thereby bringing about the phenomenal states we are in when we suffer illusions or hallucinations. Okay, so that's sort of the background view of perception. And now this account of the fundamental structure of perceptual experience yields a natural explanation of why perceptual experience has epistemic force. And the key idea is that the epistemic force of perceptual experience is grounded in properties of perceptual capacities, the employment of which constitute perceptual states. So, and in a nutshell, the idea is the following. Look, perceptual states are constituted by employing perceptual capacities. Perceptual capacities function to discriminate and single out mind-independent particulars in the environment. Perceptual states are systematically linked to what they're of in the good case. With a few additions, this follows from 1 and 2. And in virtue of being systematically linked to what they're of in the good case, perceptual states provide evidence for what they are of in the good case. So to add some meat to this skeleton of an argument here, so consider a perceiver who sees a white cup. Let's call him Percy. So Percy is in the good case. His perceptual state is systematically linked to the white cup he is seeing, in that he is perceptually related to that very cup. And his perceptual state is of the white cup, and it provides him evidence that the particular cup is present because of the systematic linkage between his perceptual state and the state of his environment. And so I refer to this view as capacitism, since the fundamental structure of perception is analyzed in terms of employing perceptual capacities. Now, what happens when we hallucinate? Well, when we suffer a hallucination, we employ the very same perceptual capacities that we would be employing were we enjoying a subjectively indistinguishable perception, albeit failing to single out the relevant particulars. And if this is worrisome to you, just think of the case of concepts. So when I possess the concept horse, you can easily imagine the case where I see a cow, or I seem to be seeing a cow coming towards me. I possess the concept horse. I refer to something coming towards me and say that's a horse. In fact, unbeknownst to me, it's a cow. No one disagrees that in such a case, I've employed my concept horse. The failure happened not at the level of employing the concept, but rather at the level of referring to the object. because there's no horse there. And I want to say the very same thing about perceptual capacities. So we can analyze the perceptual capacities that Hallie, who is hallucinating a white cup, employs with respect to the conditions for which they function, the good case, despite the fact that Hallie is not currently in such a condition. She's in the bad case. So since her perceptual capacities are working well with respect to the conditions for which they function, Hallie's perceptual state has at least some epistemic merit. It's a product of employing her perceptual capacities. The perceptual capacities are, even when employed in the bad case, systematically linked to what they are of in the good case. After all, they still function to do what they do in the good case, namely discriminate and single out the environment. And so, as I will argue in more detail shortly, when we have due to this, when we have hallucination, we have at least some evidence for believing that things are how they seem to us in virtue of employing capacities that are systematically linked to what they're of in the good case. But this is a merely weak sort of evidence that is not sufficient evidence for knowledge. And so the failing of Hallie is simply that the environment is not playing along. So the way in which Hallie is failing is not that she's not employing the capacities, but she is, unbeknownst to her, not singling out the relevant particulars. Okay, so sort of a natural objection you could have at this point is what I call an asymmetry objection. You can say, look, given that perceptual capacities can be employed while failing to single out the particulars they function to single out, you might ask why their function is to successfully single out particulars as opposed to having the function of failing to single out particulars. So what explains the asymmetry? And in response, you can say, look, any plausible account of natural function will support the idea that the heart, say, has the function to pump blood rather than fail to function to pump blood. And that's the case even though, you know, hearts may fail to pump blood, and even if they, in fact, often do fail to pump blood. So likewise, perceptual capacities have the function to single out particulars in the environment rather than fail to do so. And this is the case even if, you know, someone is, for whatever reason, hallucinating a lot. And so that's the case even though someone may fail to single out a particular and even if the person frequently fails to single out a particular. So, you know, an evolutionary account of function would posit that perceptual capacities evolved for the purposes of singling out particulars rather than for the purpose of failing to single out particulars. You know, they were selected to single out particulars. But there's no need to explain the asymmetry in evolutionary terms or indeed any other terms that ultimately, you know, have their base in a reliabilist account. The idea of a natural function is not tied into the idea of these functions being reliable or the conditions explanatory of a system having that capacity being reliable. Okay, rather, we can say that the perceptual capacities employed in the bad case are yield states with epistemic force in virtue... Is this one of these water bottles for me?
Yeah.
Are explanatory and metaphysically parasitic on their employment in the good case, and that the epistemic force of perceptual states stems from this asymmetry. So there's an explanatory primacy of the good case over the bad case, in that one could give an analysis of the perceptual capacities employed in the bad case only by appealing to their role in the good case. And this explanatory primacy is licensed by a more basic metaphysical primacy of the good case over the bad case. So there's a metaphysical primacy of the good case over the bad case in that, this is a bit complicated here, in that just the function of perceptual capacities is to do what they do in the good case rather than to do what they do in the bad case. I'm going to just leave it at that. Okay, so what we have so far is, on multiple levels, sort of two-level account. So this account of the fundamental structure of perceptual experience and its epistemic force suggests a distinction between two ways of individuating perceptual states, two ways of individuating perceptual content and two kinds of perceptual evidence. So the distinction between capacities employed and what, if anything, they single out brings into focus two ways to individuate perceptual states. And one way of individuation, the relevant features that characterize Percy, the perceiver, and Hallie, the hallucinator, is that they are they both employ the same perceptual capacities. On another way of individuation, the relevant features that characterize their mental states are different. Percy employs her capacity, thereby successfully singling out environmental particulars. Hallie employs the same capacities, but fails to single out what she purports to single out. And so that's to say that, you know, there's a metaphysically substantial common element that characterizes both Percy and Hallie's mental states, namely the perceptual capacities employed. And these perceptual capacities are in both cases suspected to link what they're of in the good case in that they function to single out particulars. Okay, and correlating to these two ways of individuating perceptual states, we can discriminate between two ways of individuating perceptual content. So, you know, assuming standardly, though not uncontroversially, that perceptual states have representational contents, this is an idea that I've argued for in a series of papers, we can say that employing such perceptual capacities yields a content type, where that content type is constituted by the perceptual capacities employed, irrespective of whether they're employed while fulfilling their function or not. So the idea being that if the same perceptual capacities are employed at T1 and at T2, the experience brought about at T1 and at T2 are have the same content type. And in this respect, Percy and Hallie's mental states are characterized by the same content type. The token content of their mental states, however, differs in that in the one case, the employing perceptual capacities in Percy's case, in the case of perception, the token content is a singular content that is constituted by successfully employing perceptual capacities in an environment, thereby singling out particulars that the perceiver purports to single out, and the capacities function to single out. And whereas in the bad case, in the hallucination case, the token content is defective insofar as the capacities are employed baselessly. So Hallie, our hallucinator, fails to single out what she purports to single out. And for reasons that are irrelevant for the talk here, I want to say that the token content of the hallucinator is gappy. But for present purposes, all we need is that it fails to be a singular content. Okay. And then, most relevantly for this talk here, these two ways of individuating perceptual states and perceptual content yield two kinds of epistemic evidence, phenomenal evidence and factor evidence. So phenomenal evidence is constituted by the content type that is in turn constituted by the perceptual capacities employed, and that's evidence that Percy and Hallie have in common, whereas fact evidence is constituted by the token content that ensues from employing these capacities successfully in a particular environment. And so the idea is that in the good case, perceptual experience provides us with both phenomenal and factive evidence. In the bad case, perceptual experience provides us only with phenomenal evidence. There's no fact evidence in the bad case because the capacities were not employed successfully and the ensuing token content is defective. And now the sort of, one of the reasons why you might find this view appealing is that there are lots of views out there on which there's both sort of an internalist element, like phenomenal evidence, and some kind of externalist element, like the fact of evidence. But what makes this view here, one of many reasons why you might like this view is that the rational source of both phenomenal evidence and fact of evidence is the very same. Namely, it stems from the perceptual capacities employed and the systematic linkage to the environment given by these perceptual capacities. So I just here on the slides included a much more detailed argument for phenomenal evidence in case anyone would want to take issue with it in the question period. I'm not going to go through the argument. I'll just say that by introducing this notion of phenomenal evidence, we can explain what evidence Persty and Halley have in common, and we can also explain in virtue of what hallucinating Halley is not simply blameworthy for her belief that there is a white cup on her desk. She has reason for believing that there is a white cup on her desk. After all, for all she can tell, there is a white cup on her desk. She has phenomenal evidence that supports her belief. And here's the argument for fact of evidence, in case anyone wants to take issue with it later on. And so by introducing this notion of fact evidence, we can explain in virtue of what Percy is better evidentially positioned than Halley. So while his evidential position may seem to him to be indistinguishable from that of Halley's, Percy has, unbeknownst to him, additional fact evidence, and thus evidence that the particular white cup to which he's perceptually related is in fact before him. And thus Percy, in contrast to Halley, has evidence that supports a singular thought about his environment. And as I'm going to argue now, Percy has indeed has sufficient evidence for knowledge. So in showing that both kinds of evidence have their rational source and employing perceptual capacities, this view, which I call capacitism, provides a unified account of perceptual evidence, one which is distinctively capacity-based, non-normative, non-reliabilist, and non-disjunctivist. Okay, so moving on to evidence and knowledge. I just want to check whether I skipped something here. And so it's an externalist view, but it's one that makes room for a phenomenal conception of evidence. And it's also one that explains in virtue of what it is that from the first person perspective, one may not be able to tell whether one is hallucinating or perceiving. Okay, so now exploiting all this for, so moving on to part two and exploiting this for a view of perceptual knowledge. So given this distinction between phenomenal evidence and fact of evidence, and given the orthodox assumption that sufficient evidence is required for knowledge, I will now argue that fact of evidence, but not phenomenal evidence, is sufficient evidence for knowledge. Okay, so as already said, capacitism explains in virtue of what one is in a better epistemic position than when one perceives, than when one hallucinates. So consider again Percy and Halley, and now consider the case where they both form the belief, you know, that cup is white. Insofar as Percy's belief is supported by more and better evidence than Halley's, namely phenomenal evidence and fact evidence, Percy's belief is better justified than Halley's. So one's evidence in the good case justifies any supported belief to a higher degree than one's evidence in the bad case. And phenomenal evidence is, of course, not sufficient evidence for knowledge, since having mere phenomenal evidence is compatible with suffering hallucination. So the idea is that the token content of perception that determines fact evidence is determined by and is covariant with the perceiver's environment and is so guaranteed to be true. And in that respect, we can say, you know, that fact evidence is infallible. So if one thinks of sufficient evidence for knowledge in terms of safety guarantees or in terms of low fallibility, then one should agree that fact of a perceptual evidence is sufficient evidence for perceptual knowledge. And if this is right, then we gain perceptual knowledge by successfully employing perceptual capacities. So more precisely, we can say that S has perceptual knowledge that P, if and only if P is true, S employed a capacity to single out what she purports to single out, and S's mental state has the content it has in virtue of S having successfully employed her capacity to single out what she purports to single out. And sort of as a side note, this view gives an explanation of what it means for knowledge to be a mental state, sort of gives substance to this sort of metaphor that knowledge is a mental state. So insofar as capacities are, you know, mental tools of a certain kind by means of which we relate to our environment, the states yielded by employing such capacities are naturally mental states. And moreover, insofar as successfully employing capacities yields perceptual knowledge, capacitism entails that knowledge is a mental state. So it substantiates the metaphor that knowledge is a mental state in virtue of mental states being constituted by employing mental capacities. Now, orthodoxy obviously has it that one cannot know that P without believing that P. But this view, which you may or may not think is a good-making feature, does not have any belief condition on knowledge. I mean, it's compatible that you also believe, but there's no such requirement. And at least for a view about perceptual knowledge, this is highly attractive for two reasons. One is that I can see that P without forming any beliefs about P. And this better be the case. After all, if we would form beliefs based on everything we see, we would suffer a sort of extreme cognitive overload. And the second is that I can know that P simply in virtue of seeing that P. Any belief, any perceptual belief will of course be grounded in a perceptual experience, but being grounded in a perceptual experience is not the same as the perceptual state constituting a perceptual belief. And for these reasons, I'm going to be talking about justified mental states and what follows rather than justified beliefs. And these justified mental states may be beliefs, but they need not be. And a reason I haven't specified here is that, you know, animals, at least the way we talk, which you may or may not give a lot of weight to, you know, we very naturally talk of animals as knowing this or that, much less so than that they believe this or that. And so the reasons to think of knowledge as a much more basic, primitive mental state that doesn't itself rely on beliefs, and this is a view of perceptual knowledge that kind of easily accommodates that. And of course, accepting this is compatible with saying that there are more high-level kinds of knowledge that do require beliefs. But this is a way of talking about perceptual knowledge where you can give an analysis, you can substantiate what the perceptual knowledge amounts to without even mentioning beliefs. Okay, now justified mental states that fall short of knowledge can obviously be true or false or accurate or inaccurate, and such mental states share certain features with knowledge states. They are states on which perceptual capacities are employed and states that have at least some justification. And perception yields such knowledge states, whereas hallucinations and illusions yield justified mental states that fall short of knowledge. But so the relevant difference between justified mental states that fall short of knowledge and knowledge states is that the latter, but not the former, are ones in which capacities are employed such that they do what they function to do. But beyond the capacities being employed such they do what they function to do, there is nothing additional in play in the case of knowledge that is not in play in the case of a mere justified mental state. Okay, and now to give more substance to this idea, I am going to apply it to perceptual, to Gedia cases. And given, I don't actually know when I started, but given the advanced time, I'm pretty sure I'm not going to get to the next sections. Okay. So the standard analysis of Gedia cases is that a subject has a true belief and sufficient evidence for knowledge, but still lacks knowledge. And so far, what I've done is I've introduced a distinction between fact evidence, present only in the good case, and mere phenomenal evidence, present as a common element in both the good case and the bad case. And what I've further done is that I've sketched a conception of knowledge on which fact evidence constitutes sufficient evidence for knowledge, while phenomenal evidence does not. And so to exploit this for analyzing Gedia cases, so the standard analysis of Gedia cases is, you know, too simplistic. And what I'm going to argue is that the subject in at least certain kinds of Gedia cases, namely perceptual Gedia cases, lacks sufficient evidence for knowledge. She has phenomenal evidence, but fails to have fact evidence. And since she does not have fact evidence, she fails to have sufficient evidence for knowledge. And this is going to allow me to explain why the subject in a perceptual Gedia case lacks knowledge without appealing to anything beyond a sufficient evidence requirement. So I offer a way of handling perceptual Gedje cases without appeal to any factor beyond that of evidence. Okay, so so here's a case that is a very slight adjustment of, whoops, of cases you're all very familiar with, and it's actually one sort of out there in the literature. So, you know, take the case where James is relaxing on a bench in a park and sees what he takes to be a dog in a nearby field. On the basis of a perception, he believes there is a dog in the field. And as it happens, this apparent dog is actually a robot dog, but one that looks just like a real dog. So, and James does not know that robot dogs exist. So if that was a full description of the case, James' belief there was a dog in the field would be false. However, a few feet away from the robot dog, there happens to be a real dog in the same field, concealed from James' view. So James' belief there is a dog in the field happens, unbeknownst to James, to be true. Okay, so what should we make of this case? So, as you all know, the standard approach is to say that James' belief there's a dog in the field is both true and supported by sufficient evidence for knowledge. And the motivation for this approach is that there is, in fact, a dog in the field, and the belief was formed based on ordinary perceptual processes, albeit on grounds of perceiving a robot dog rather than the actual dog on the field. And the reasoning seems to stem from the internalist idea that James is doing just the same thing from his own perspective as a successful perceiver would be doing in a simple case of seeing a dog in the field with no robots or other complications. And so, according to this capacitist view, the verdict on the case is different. So on that view, the view I'm suggesting, James' belief has some justification. After all, James employs his capacity to single out a dog, and in virtue of this, he is in a mental state that is intentionally directed at a dog. And being in this mental state provides him with some evidence for his belief that there is a dog in the field. It provides him with phenomenal evidence. So James has a justified true belief. We all want that. But however, since James is not in fact perceptually related to a dog and so does not single out a dog, he does not have factive evidence of a dog. He only singled out the robot. So James has phenomenal evidence but fails to have fact evidence that there is a dog in the field. And since phenomenal evidence is not sufficient evidence for knowledge, James does not have sufficient evidence to know that there is a dog in the field. Okay, and so James believes truly, but he does not believe truly in virtue of successfully employing his capacity to single out a dog. So more generally, the Gediate subject believes truly, but she does not believe truly in virtue of her mental state having been arrived at by employing capacities that function to do what they're supposed to do, or what they function to do. So I'm arguing that perceptual knowledge is best understood in terms of employing perceptual capacity that function to discriminate and single out particulars in the environment, such that when these capacities are employed successfully, the subject enjoys a mental state that is both true and justified. And the key is that knowledge differs from mere justified true mental states, in that the capacities employed in knowledge, in fact, succeed in serving their natural function, whereas in mere justified true mental states, the capacities are employed without succeeding in serving their natural function. Okay, so more generally, we can say that when we employ the capacity to discriminate and single out a particular at location L in our environment, and we in fact discriminate and single out that particular at location L, we gain fact evidence and thus perceptual knowledge of the particular at location L. And in a Gedje case, the particular at location L is not in fact the particular that the subject purports to single out. So in this case, the subject employs capacities that fail to discriminate and single out the particular at location L. And this is the case even if there is a particular at location L star that the subject could have successfully singled out but did not in fact successfully single out, you know, as in the robot dog case. And so, in short, the perceptual Gedje cases are just like hallucinations in that capacities are employed without fulfilling their function. The only difference to the normal case of hallucination is that there is an external mind-independent ground for employing the capacity elsewhere in the environment. You're looking at me in a way that suggests that my time is up. Am I reading your perceptual expression correctly? Okay. So I'm just going to very briefly say, like several others, I want to say that Barr and Facade County cases should not really be treated as Gedia cases. In that case, you just have perceptual knowledge. When you see the barn in Barr and Facade County, and I can explain more how that goes if anyone wants to know. And then there are sort of more sort of complex cases, such as the broken clock case. And I'm just going to skip through all this. I'm just going to skip through all of this. I'm going to conclude. Okay. So what I've done is I've offered a distinctive externalist view of perceptual evidence that does not invoke reliability, remains steadfastly naturalistic, and recognizes a metaphysically substantial and epistemically relevant common element between perception and hallucination. So the idea is that to ground the epistemic force of experience in the metaphysical properties of experience, and it is because a given subject is employing perceptual capacities with a certain nature that her mental states have epistemic force. Employing such perceptual capacities yields a mental state that provides us with phenomenal evidence, and employing such capacities in the good case, moreover, provides us with knowledge-worthy factive evidence. In perceptual Gedia cases, the subject only has phenomenal evidence and so lacks sufficient evidence for knowledge. And this approach is distinctive in three respects. It groups perceptual Gedia cases in with hallucinations. It treats both via a lack of sufficient evidence rather than through invoking some sort of fourth condition. As I only very briefly pointed at, it divides up perceptual Gedia cases from fake barn cases that are just regular cases of perceptual knowledge, from broken clock cases that appeal to some kind of inferential knowledge. But the key is that the underlying picture of perceptual knowledge avoids the pitfalls of both externalist disjunctivist views on the one hand and internalist views on the other, while revealing what is right in both externalist and internalist approaches. So thank you very much.